This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte was jolted by the street violence that followed the police shooting of Keith Scott. The violence was an example of misdirected expression of frustration over that shooting and the cumulative effects of the deaths of African-American males at the hands of police around the country. Charlottesians witnessing that violence sometimes found it difficult to express their shock and disbelief that something like that could happen here. Both sides found self-expression difficult or focused that expression in a destructive direction. That isn't a problem that is particular to Charlotte. Many times people find expressing themselves to be difficult, and that is where the art world can possibly help. Following the property destruction downtown, area artists here expressed themselves in a positive way by decorating the boarded-up windows. Artists have often found ways to constructively channel emotions that many of us find difficult, and the role of artists in the social and political realm has become a big topic in that community. Across the nation, artists and arts organizations are asking what they can do, what they should not do. Following the 1991 L.A. riots, actor Roger Genevieve Smith turned Rodney King's story into a one-man show, which has played major cities around the country and which he'll be performing at UNC Charlotte tonight at 7:30 at Belk Theater in Robinson Hall. Mr. Smith is an actor, writer, director who has appeared in films like American Gangster and Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Welcome. Nice to have you here. You've done, as I've said, your share of making your living the way most actors do in plays, in television, and in films. The Birth of a Nation, you just did that film recently, To a Different World on television. But you seem to have been specializing in creating acting pieces that have something important to say. You've done pieces on Frederick Douglass. You've done one on Huey P. Newton. I don't know whether the question should be why you do that or why most other actors don't.
Not all actors are writers, and not all actors are directors as well. And I try to do all of those three things sometimes simultaneously. And sometimes I'm successful, and quite frequently I am challenged by the experience. But it's a challenge that is worthwhile, and as Mr. Douglass said, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. You suggested that I've been doing this Rodney King performance since 1991. I have not. I started doing this in the summer of 2012, which is when we lost Mr. King on Father's Day in a tragic accident at his home. He drowned in his backyard pool. Mm-hmm. In 1991, he was beaten savagely, right, by the Los Angeles Police Department. A year later, those police officers, Kuhn, Powell, Brasino, and Wind, were brought to trial in Los Angeles and were found not guilty of virtually all charges against them. And the city exploded in April and May of 1992. It was Rodney King, who was probably brain damaged, probably drunk, and certainly disappointed at the verdicts, and certainly traumatized by the loss of life that was expended in Los Angeles at that time in his name.
Yeah, 50 people died, right?
He was beaten by the Los Angeles Police Department, it's estimated 56 times. Blows were struck at Mr. King. 56 lives were lost in Los Angeles at that time. It's a strange mathematical ratio.
So, and as you said, you didn't come up with this piece following the riots. You came up with it following Rodney King's death. Why? What about that moment in time triggered not only your interest in this, but the work it takes to put something like this together?
I was extraordinarily moved when I opened up my laptop and saw that we had lost Mr. King, particularly the way that we had lost him. I had referenced Rodney King for 20-some-odd years throughout my work, never as the butt of a joke, never as a punchline, but I saw him as a symbol of a certain resilience, a certain survival mechanism. And Rodney King then was in the middle of a resurgence, so we thought. It was the 20th anniversary of the Los Angeles riots, and he had just published an autobiography entitled The Riot Within. And he was doing book tours and public appearances, and was very well received. And those of us who cared about Rodney King said to ourselves, yes, Rodney is back. Yes, Rodney is beating his demons. Mm-hmm. And it was especially disheartening that we lost him in June of 2012. So I wanted to know, why was I moved? Why did I feel as if I had lost someone whom I knew personally? I didn't know him personally. I knew him only publicly. I knew him only politically. I knew him only theatrically. So I wanted to explore that emotion of my own and to extend that to my potential audience.
And you've taken this this piece all over the country. You've played places like the Public Theater in New York and the Woolly Mammoth Theater in D.C. Now you're here tonight at 7:30 at the UNC Charlotte. What is it about this piece that speaks to people, that allows you to take this all over the country, that theaters call you and say, we'd like you to do this for us?
Well, I think that first off, it's the portrait of a man in a box. A man with a public persona whose private life was not understood, not known, not cared about. In fact, Rodney King was not what his family and friends called him. They called him Glenn. Hmm. So in a sense, Rodney King was an invention of that moment, March 3rd, 1991, you see. So the reclamation of the man behind the myth is really the great challenge of this piece, and it's what I do quite frequently with my work on public personae like Huey P. Newton or Frederick Douglass.
Was it easier to find information on Frederick Douglass than it was to find information on Rodney King that was suitable to make a theatrical piece out of it?
Not necessarily. It depends upon what you consider to be theatrical. Douglass, of course, was a great speaker, but we don't have any recording of his speeches. He died in 1895, but by all accounts, he was the greatest speaker in an era of public speaking, in which public speaking was used not only as communication, but as a form of entertainment. Rodney King was not a great public speaker, but I happen to think that the speech that he did make May 1st, 1992, his May Day address, in which he asked, can we get along? When he did that speech, I think it continues to resonate as one of the great speeches in American history.
Why?
Because it stopped a riot, you see. And that other king, whose birthday we will be celebrating next week, mm-hmm. made a lot of great speeches as well, but he never stopped a riot. Mm-hmm. Rodney King could have gotten up and said, hey, burn it down, let's burn it down. And you know, there are some among us who would have said, yeah, right on. You can say that. You have the right to say that. Burn it down, because here are four men who have beaten you, Officers Kung, Pao, Brasino, and Wind, who have walked. And Rodney King dug deep into his spirit, deep into his humanity, and challenged us to get along. And he asked that question, that pertinent question, that basic question, that primitive question at the beginning of his speech. Can we all get along? And he answers his own question at the end of the speech when he says, yes, we can. We can.
that we're in, but also I've worked on work with Rodney King before and helping students understand that what happened is part of a historical context. It's something that's been happening. But also just listening to him talk, I knew from personal experience how great it would be for our students to meet someone like that, to see how history can feed into theater, and to meet someone who has a heart for mentoring and teaching students and has also been a successful actor, director, producer. So I knew it would be a good experience for our students. And our chair agreed, and our faculty agreed.
And here he is.
And here he is.
And one of your areas of research concerns the way in which theater can be used to facilitate these complex cultural conversations. Theater is storytelling. Why does using the storytelling in a theater piece make it easier for people to have a conversation about these complex issues, or even to get insight or understand some of the underpinnings of what's going on around them?
I think there's two sides to it. So the first side is, as an audience, they come in, and instead of hearing a headline, so Rodney King said this or Keith Scott said this, they come in and they get to know the person. They know that it's a family. An actor's job is to get into a person, to understand why they do what they do, mm-hmm. where they're coming from. And so if actors are successful, they help people understand the person behind a headline. Yeah. So it's more than a 5-minute news clip. The second thing is
40 seconds
or 40 second news clip. Yes. The second thing is that the students or the actors, as they go through the process, learn to understand where someone is coming from. So when I've done this before, students got to walk in shoes. I did a piece where students played different genders and different ethnicities than they were, and they got to walk in the shoes of somebody that they didn't understand. And to successfully portray any character, you have to understand who they are, where they're coming from. That's something we generally don't do in our discussion of current events right now. Yep. We tend to classify these people are violent, these people don't understand, these people. And theater gets into that basic human instinct to tell a story and to help us understand who people are.
And you keep mentioning the students because you're a teacher at UNC yeah. Charlotte, but this particular performance is open to the public and it's
yes.
free. And it's part. That's one of the reasons that universities are valuable in communities, because it opens conversations about things that only students are normally exposed to. Kate emails, as Meryl Streep said this week, I think at the Golden Globes, an actor's only job is to enter the lives of people who are different from us and let you feel what that feels like. That's what you're doing in this piece.
I should hope so. And I certainly am happy to have the experience of presenting it here in Charlotte. I've had a great time in North Carolina. Working with this piece, I was actually at Playmakers at UNC Chapel Hill.
Okay.
And had a great run there. I've played at the National Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem. I've played down in Wilmington as well.
And now you're here.
We're going to take a break right now.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Regional Partnership, which markets the 16-county, two-state region known as Charlotte, USA, to companies looking to expand or relocate in our market. Information about supporting the effort at charlotteusa.com. And Carolina Asthma and Allergy Center, offering patient care to all ages, dedicated to treating and curing asthma and allergy challenges. 11 locations in the Charlotte area. Breathe, live, thrive. CarolinaAsthma.com. 4-time NASCAR Cup Series champion driver Jeff Gordon retired last year, but he's really still working. He's moved from the track to the broadcast booth, continues to race. He's preparing right now for the sports car race in Daytona this month. He also works, of course, with the Jeff Gordon Children's Foundation, supporting pediatric cancer research. And that just scratches the surface. Jeff Gordon explores it all with us tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, ethics and the Trump cabinet. Confirmation hearings begin before ethics reviews are completed. It's unprecedented. We're on it. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to actor, writer, director Roger Gunver-Smith, who is Rodney King tonight in the performance of Rodney King, his one-man show at Robinson Hall's Belk Theater at 7:30. It's free. It's open to the public at UNC. And Kaja Dunn is also with us. She's an assistant professor of acting there on campus. There are lots of people, and I've heard this said so many times, who believe that art should be pretty and that theater should be a safe place, a place for entertainment, not for provocation, not for confrontation. You believe that theater is a place where we do the undoable and where we say the unsayable. Theater, you have said, is where we commit murder.
Absolutely.
Explain that to people who just want to go see Sound of Music.
Well, Sound of Music is cool, but
Sound of Music had a rebellion in it.
It sure did. Well, unless you're a Nazi sympathizer.
Then there's a discussion to be had after that, too.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to go see Hamlet, and sometimes you got to go see Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Mm-hmm. But when you're doing a piece like Rodney King, which does make you think, which brings up some issues that we haven't dealt with very well in this country, that can be uncomfortable for some people. It shocks them out of their stupor, I guess, and they don't like it. They feel uncomfortable. That's a good thing?
I think it's a necessary thing. I think that if we were exposed more frequently and more comprehensively to the theater, we would perhaps have less conflict outside of the theater. I think that if we had, for example, leaders who are willing to send our young people off to war as cannon fodder, had been exposed to perhaps Henry V, had been exposed perhaps to All My Sons, would be less likely, perhaps, to be engaged in the senseless pursuit of violence as a means of conflict. I would much rather that our violent tendencies be resolved within the sphere of the theater. Mm-hmm. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, mm-hmm. a kingdom for a stage.
Playwright August Wilson has made a career out of telling the stories of ordinary people whose stories have not been told but that deserve to be told, as Viola Davis said at the Golden Globes the other night, because she's in Fences, which is one of his plays, which has been turned into a film with Denzel Washington.
Directed by Denzel Washington.
And yes, directed by him as well. It's through the telling of these stories that an appreciation for those people begins, as well as understanding. And it's also through those stories that healing begins?
Well, I think that healing, as another great American by the name of Malcolm Little, otherwise known as Malcolm X, mm-hmm. he reminds us that the healing process is only part of the process of reconciliation. That, for example, if one is stabbed, then that knife has to be removed, and then that wound has to be sutured, mm-hmm. and then that wound has to heal, and then that person who has been stabbed must be protected so that they're not stabbed again. So the process of healing, so-called, is not as simple as we might like to think it mm-hmm. would be. So the remedy for the dilemma, which is suggested by the story of Rodney King, is something that is complicated, and it is a long-term process of reconciliation, of remuneration, mm-hmm. if you will.
You've done these other one-man shows about Frederick Douglass and Huey P. Newton. Is Rodney King, in your mind, in that same universe, or is this simply a story that needs to be told because it is contemporary and because it speaks to what's happening now?
Well, for me, it's an autobiography in progress. All of these stories are part of my own story, and Nobody gave me $1 million and said, hey, do Rodney King, right. Hey, do Juan Marichal, do John Roseboro, do Frederick Douglass. These are stories, these are people that come out of my own imagination. As a child, I read the Encyclopedia Britannica for fun.
I read that about you.
My mother had a two-volume set called The World's Great Men of Color by J.A. Rogers in our home library, and I devoured those biographical sketches. When I was a boy, I was exposed to the great Hal Holbrook and his one-man show, Mark Twain Tonight.
Right.
And I thought in doing an honors project in American Studies at Occidental College, my undergraduate alma mater, that I might go about the business of playing Mr. Frederick Douglass. Mm. And so I put gray in my hair. It's there now. I don't have to put gray in my hair anymore. But I continue to include Douglass as part of my repertoire. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited because next year we're going to celebrate the bicentennial of Frederick Douglass, who was born in 1818. So in 2018, we will celebrate that bicentennial.
You mentioned Hal Holbrook. Talk to me about the one-man show and how that works. Is it more effective to tell certain stories that way? Because you have at least three under your belt, and then you mentioned Hal, and there are other people who have done one-man
I have about shows. 10 under my belt, okay. Actually.
Wow.
But Hal Holbrook demonstrated to me as a boy that one could be effective as a solo performer. One could engage history as well. And one could be flexible enough to speak to the political moment. From what I understand, Mr. Holbrook has hours and hours of Mark Twain material memorized, committed to memory, and then for whatever political moment, he will pull out those passages. And some of my work has existed in that realm. Some is very strictly scripted. But that was very exciting to know that, to find that out. And, you know, I took my daughter to see Hal Holbrook not long ago in San Diego. And it was rather miraculous that this man has been doing this since the mid-1950s and continues to do it.
Right.
Is an extraordinary role model, I think, not just for me, but I think for anybody who wants to pursue their dreams.
Talk to me about your show, Rodney King. How do you do it? I've not seen it, so I can't speak from experience. I've seen little clips of it on YouTube. Mm. You're not necessarily portraying Rodney King. You're not showing what happened to him necessarily in those riots in L.A. in 1991. And you're bringing other comments about Rodney King into that hour of performance. Talk to me about the show.
Well, I play kind of a narrator, a journalist, who's asking Rodney King questions that are impossible to answer. And perhaps within the silence there, we, meaning the player, myself, and the audience, can come to some sort of overstanding of who Rodney King was.
You said overstanding. Did you mean to say that?
I did mean to say that.
What does that mean?
Well, it comes from Jamaican Rasta lingo, in which one would never engage as something under in a positive way. It would always be over.
Okay.
So, you know, if you ask a Rasta, you know, if you would understand something, the Rasta would say, I and I overstand.
Okay.
So that's where that comes from.
Do you need to get into a lot of the backstory, a lot of Rodney King's story, what led him to become?
Oh, absolutely! And
there's a whole generation of people.
That's a great pleasure for me because I like archival work, and I dug into the archives for several weeks before stepping out on stage. I didn't interview people who knew him. I didn't interview family, friends. I had done that before with other characters. But I wanted to maintain the position of the outsider. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to take myself out of the equation as much as possible. So I excised the word I, the personal pronoun I, in reference to Roger Genber Smith, because I didn't want this to be about my relationship to the story. Of course it is, because I'm the one who's playing it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the narrative structure, mm-hmm. I wanted to take that out. I also begin the piece with a rap by a guy by the name of Willie D, who came to fame with a group out of Houston's Fifth Ward called the Ghetto Boys. And when Rodney King made his speech May 1st, 1992, Willie D immediately wrote a rap called F, and I'm not going to say it because we're on NPR, F Rodney King, mm-hmm. because he did not feel that Rodney King had lived up to his standards of machismo, that Rodney King should not be in a forgiving mood, that Rodney King would better have said, burn it down. But I felt that it was a provocative way of starting this piece and a way of engaging a point of view,
yeah.
that was not necessarily pro-Rodney King, because certainly there are voices out there who are not pro-Rodney King from a variety of neighborhoods. And even on the day that he died, if you went online, you would see scurrilous, scandalous, anti-Rodney King rhetoric from anonymous sources, of
what
course,
do you,
who are hiding behind right. their computers.
What do you think of Rodney King? You, obviously, you're not in that camp.
I told you.
That's right.
I felt that he was a symbol of okay. of resilience, that he was a survivor. And I was quite moved when I lost him, and I haven't changed that.
You mentioned that as a child you read the Encyclopedia Britannica for fun, and that your parents had this two-volume set of The World's Great Men of Color and the autobiography of Frederick Douglass called An American Slave. A lot of kids today aren't exposed to any of those things. They have Google, but they don't read, and they don't have Encyclopedia Britannica sitting on the shelf in their home. And then you went on to Yale to major in history, if I'm not mistaken, and kind of found your way to their incredible theater department at Yale University. Are you approaching this more as an actor, director, theater person, or are you bringing a lot of your history credentials into this and the other pieces that you have done of historical?
I mean, the hyphen, yeah, you can do a multi-hyphen, actor, director,
historian.
Writer, historian. But primarily, Mike, I want to function as a responsible citizen, you see. Because if I don't function as a citizen of this country, then I have really no right to call myself an artist. Because to be an artist in our society is a great privilege and a great responsibility.
Why is that? That sounds very much like what you would have heard at the Golden Globes this past weekend from people of the Hollywood elite, as they are now called. Why does that...
They're overrated.
Why does that seem to threaten so many people? Because, as you say, artists are citizens. And because artists express themselves, that's what they do, that's what art is, it's an expression. Why is that threatening?
Big Paul, the king of them all, y'all. All American at playing ball, but that wasn't all. He was a Phi Beta Kappa Shakespearean rapper. Big Paul stood tall, y'all. Yes, he was born in the USA, but in his heyday, they took his passport away. Why? Because they didn't like what he had to say, okay? Like, here I stand, an African-American,
son of a slave, from the cradle to the grave. Are you now, or have you ever been aware of him? Understood why they were scared of him? Big Paul, the king of them all, y'all. Now, you're a North Carolinian. You should know of whom I speak.
Paul Robeson.
Of course. And his ancestors are from right there in Robeson County. He grew up in New Jersey. Paul Robeson said that the artist must elect to fight for freedom or for slavery. I've made my choice. I had no alternative. And when he went before the House in the 1950s, and his
House on Un-American Activities Committee in the 1950s.
It was the House.
Yeah.
It was the House. He said that Frederick Douglass could be sitting here right now. And it was suggested that he leave this country. And he said, no. I'm not going anywhere because my people built this country. You see? Mm-hmm. And that's why citizenship precludes artistry.
You deal with young people who want to become actors every day. Do they talk about things like this? Do they consider themselves citizens first, actors second?
Absolutely. We had a protest on campus organized with students, and the students are really excited about what is happening. I think, you know, you mentioned I had the encyclopedias in my house too.
And we couldn't afford the Britannica. You get Funkin' Wagnalls.
but that's, you know, you mentioned Google, but that's where Google becomes exciting. But it's, are we giving them the tools to do this? So UNC Charlotte has a long history of doing socially engaged theater. The students haven't been exposed to it before. When they come to us, a lot of them in their high schools have done The Importance of Being Earnest, right, or Romeo and Juliet, which is great. But I grew up never being able to do a work by a person of color until I got to my third year of college. And then we did Raisin in the Sun. Mm. So I think it's, the students are interested. It's whether we're giving them the opportunities to explore this.
That's Kaya Dunn, an assistant.
Kaya
Dunn, at assistant professor of acting at UNC Charlotte. Also here, Roger Gunvir Smith in Rodney King tonight at 7:30. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and DryPro, specializing in residential and commercial waterproofing to remedy mold-causing moisture in your home or business. More information at dryprofoundation.com. And Charlotte Concerts, presenting the Hot Club of San Francisco, America's longest-running gypsy jazz ensemble. Their vintage gypsy swing sounds are reminiscent of the 1930s small jazz clubs of Paris. McGlowan Theater, January 19th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets available at charlottetix.org. Confirmation hearings for President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees are beginning before ethics reviews are completed. That happens to be an unprecedented move. So, today on Point, Tom Ashbrook and his guests discuss the ethical quandaries facing the potential Trump cabinet. That's all upcoming in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And we are coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
In Brazil, funerals are being held for the men who died in the worst prison riot in that country for a quarter century.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Charlotte School of Law has the highest rate of first-year students dropping out due to academic reasons. Florida Coastal has the second highest.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. You can join our conversation, which we're having about art and the intersection of art and social justice and how art can shed light on some of the issues and some of the topics that we struggle to understand in our daily lives. We're having that conversation with Roger Gensler-Smith, who is portraying Rodney King in a one-man show. He is the writer, the director, the actor in charge at 7:30 tonight at Robinson Hall's Belk Theater at UNC Charlotte. It's free. It's open to the public. Also with us is Kaya Dunn, assistant professor of acting there.
There's someone else speaking tonight, actually, and that person is not speaking until 9 o'clock.
After the show.
Yes.
Steve Crump from WBTV. He's facilitating a discussion.
No, actually, I was talking about President Barack Obama, who's giving his farewell address at 9 p.m. Eastern time, but we'll be done
by then. Okay.
Starting at 7:30, and we'll be finishing up at 8:30, and we'll have a conversation with Mr. Crump,
right.
And then we'll perhaps be hearing from someone else who might have something to say tonight.
You know, when most people, and I think this is probably one of the reasons why you wanted to do this, because you have said that you wanted to find out why Rodney King's death in 2012 touched you so. That's one of the reasons why you involved yourself in this project. A lot of us, when we hear of a Rodney King or a Keith Smith or other situations where it's on the news a lot, we immediately jump.
Who's Keith Smith?
He's the young. He's the gentleman who was killed by a Charlotte Mecklenburg police officer recently in this town that led to Keith Lamont Scott. Excuse me,
yeah.
Keith Lamont Scott.
Oh yeah, I know.
I told you off the air. I'm name challenged.
Okay.
Anyway. We jump to conclusions. Stereotypes are easy to pin on people because all we get is these sound bites of individuals, and we see the same sound bite over and over again, and very little changes our mind because we're seeing the same thing over and over again. This gives you a chance. This piece gives you a chance to really get under the skin of Rodney King, really find out about who he was, what he may have thought. That was the goal, right?
Well, and also to create, hopefully, an effective piece of theater.
Yes.
That functions not simply as a biographical sketch, mm-hmm. but also as something that is moving, perhaps, transforming, perhaps, educational, perhaps. There's some amazing stories within the story. For example, Reginald Denny, who is notorious as one of the victims of the riots, a man who was pulled out of his truck and beaten to a bloody pulp and then spirited to a hospital miraculously. It turns out that he and Rodney King had worked together on a construction site.
Really?
Really. And Rodney King realizes that when his identity is finally revealed. Rodney King is a second-generation alcoholic drowning victim. He found his father when he was a teenager drowned in his bathtub. That's biblical. I don't know if you can, you know, imaginatively create something of that nature. August Wilson could.
The New York Times, don't cut yourself too short, because they've called your play sinuous, complicated, and deeply moving. How would you describe it?
I would describe it as continuously challenging. I've played this all over the world,
mm-hmm.
taken it to London, to Amsterdam, to the West Indies. I've been all over the United States. And each community, each environment brings to it a certain sensitivity or non-sensitivity to the story, which has to be negotiated each night, night after night.
Why, I was going to ask you at some point in this conversation how audiences in different cities here in this country and different cities around the world have reacted to this, but why would an audience in Amsterdam understand it, be expected to understand it? Because there's so much Americanism in this.
Because the Anne Frank House is in Amsterdam. And the story of human darkness is not unknown to the Dutch. Mm-hmm. The story of colonial conflict is not unknown to the Dutch. And in fact, when we go abroad, we find that perhaps those abroad are more adamantly engaged in American history than we are here in America.
Yeah, they seem to know a lot about a lot of things, and a lot of inside information about countries around the world, and particularly about America, because we are the big kahuna, and we take ourselves for granted, and they don't, in many cases.
In some cases. But, you know, before I was starting to work on Rodney King, I was working on a piece about Otto Frank, who is the father of Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. And oddly enough, it was Rodney King who took me to Amsterdam, where I had the opportunity to go to the Anne Frank house and be in that very dark garret above the shop and experience that. And I would not have had that experience had Rodney King not taken me there.
Yeah.
And that's a compelling story, the story of Otto Frank, of course, who was the only survivor of his immediate family, who was then given a diary when he was liberated from the concentration camp by a family friend. He had given this diary as a blank to his daughter Anne, and she had filled it. And it took him months to read it. And then many more months to decide what he was going to do with it. And then it was decided that, you know, he would share it with the world. And there were those people who said that, no, you shouldn't share this story. It's exploitative. And there are even deniers who said that it never happened. You're making it all up. And that's something with which Otto Frank lived for the rest of his life. And that, too, is kind of the portrait of a man in a box,
yeah,
if you will.
You've called this play less of a performance than a prayer.
I had thought that it would exist simply as a memorial for that season. I went on stage at Bootleg Theater in Los Angeles, which is my home theater, in August of 2012, thinking that it would exist simply as a memory, a very brief memory of Rodney King. But for some reason, you know, the story keeps pulling me back in. Mm. And what has happened, particularly in this country, even in this city where we're speaking right now, has made Rodney King's story even more relevant, even more resonant, even more crucial, even more necessary. And we had the opportunity last August to perform Rodney King outdoors in New York City on the hottest day of the year. It was 102 degrees. Mm. And we documented it. And look for it on Netflix in April. It's directed by my longtime colleague, Mr. Spike Lee, and this is our 10th collaboration.
Talk about that for a second, because here you are. You've written this, you've researched it, you've acted it for several years now as a one-man theatrical production, and then you've had Rodney King commit it, I guess, I was going to say to film, but I'm sure it's tape. It's digital at the very least, and it's going to be on Netflix. So Rodney King comes in as director. What does he do to your piece, to your performance?
Spike Lee.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Spike. See, I told you. Name challenge. What does a Spike Lee do? How does he change you? Does he change you? Does he just focus it for the camera versus the stage? What does he do?
Well, Spike and I have been collaborating since the late 1980s. And we know each other pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And we trust each other implicitly. So what he does is he brings his A-team to the table, and they are armed with video cameras, in this case 15 of them, to capture a live performance in one take.
What kind of pressure is that for you?
It's not unlike the pressure that I'll be feeling tonight at 7:30 at University of North Carolina
tonight,
Charlotte.
Yeah, but tonight at 7:30 is not only live, and therefore it will evaporate the minute it's done. It's also in front of a much smaller audience than Netflix can bring you. And when you commit something to video, it's permanent. No pressure? No extra pressure? I know you've done a lot of film.
I'd like to hope that what I'm going to do tonight is permanent as well.
Right.
That when you come to see it, Mike, and you sit in the front row, that you will be getting images and ideas that will be with you for the rest of your life.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things we're hoping to do is use it as the start of a conversation. So it's the piece, and then it's the discussion afterwards, so that we're bringing the Charlotte community together. And Roger mentioned it was supposed to be a memorial. I just turned 11 when Rodney King happened, or I was about to turn 11. And I remember people telling me this will never happen again. And now I'm working with students as a professor who are struggling with why this keeps happening. And I think that's one of the things we're hoping to address tonight, so that it's not fleeting, but that this is the start. You know, we're bringing him in, and it'll be great to see the show, but also this city needs to continue the discussion.
Okay. Dave emails, what role, because we've been talking pretty seriously here, but he says, what role, if any, does humor or levity play in transformative theater?
Richard Pryor, I think, is a great example of someone who, you know, brought a comic edge to material that is resonating on other levels as well. Social, political commentary, but, you know, with a comic edge all the while. I think that, you know, Richard Pryor was a great solo performance artist. And I think that Bob Marley was a great dancer. And I think that John Coltrane was a great philosopher. And I think that Nina Simone was a great spiritualist. These are great artists who are operating on a variety of levels, but primarily, again, working as citizens of the world.
And putting these people into different categories than what they're known for. You have said that you've learned more by listening to your friend Branford Marsalis than you ever have in an acting workshop. And when I watched some of the clips of this, the way you speak passages of this, your cadence, the tempo, the varying speed of things, and where you try to put in pauses, it's very musical.
Well, I aspire to musicality. I aspire to jazz. I've listened to Branford play jazz standards, April in Paris, what have you, many times over. Sometimes I'll sit in and listen to, you know, two or three sets a night in a club setting, perhaps. And I learn a lot because the songs are always played with truth. There's always a story to be told, but that truth, that story is told in a different way each time. I collaborate with Mark Anthony Thompson, who does sound design for Rodney King. And he has described our work as song cycles, you know, in which we sing the same songs every night, but we sing them differently every night.
How much of this is improvised?
Well, it began as total improvisation. The only scripted pieces really were Rodney King's speech, which I knew I wanted to do in entirety, and the first two verses of Willie D's rap, which is entitled F. Rodney King. I can't say it.
No, please don't. I'm begging you.
So, and in between, a number of improvisations, both through the narrative and also through the movement. One thing that I did do for myself is create a kind of box, a literal box, a white rectangle in which this piece is played in. And I wanted it to be amplified because I enjoy using the microphone, and I think that it can do certain things with the human voice that the human voice cannot do on its own. And I wanted that microphone to be attached to a cord. I didn't want a cordless microphone. I thought that it was very suggestive because Rodney King's father, you see, beat him with an electric cord, perhaps preparing him for bigger beatings to come. Mm. And there are many, many water allusions in this piece. And the mixture of electricity and water is something that, you know, is very dangerous. So we want to suggest that. And we want to invite our audience to come on and enjoy some electricity tonight at 7:30.
Be at the Belk Theater at the UNC Charlotte. It's open to the public. It is free. There'll be a discussion afterwards with Steve Crump from WBTV, who's a documentarian and has done a lot of different stories that haven't been told before or not been told well. He'll be there to facilitate that conversation. Kaya Dunn, assistant acting professor at UNC Charlotte, thank you for bringing Roger Guinevere-Smith was here today. He's the actor, writer, and director who is portraying Rodney King tonight. Thanks for the hour.